closing nearly 100,000 satisfied clients in 2003. Get your mortgage questions answered today. Visit us online right now, rockfinancial.com. That's rockfinancial.com.
Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company and equal housing lender. Call the mortgage experts now, 800-333-ROCK.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Doggy treats. The lady in front of you needs to know the price on a box of doggy treats. Is the low-fat kind in the green box the same price as the regular kind in the blue box? Either way, your life has come to a complete standstill, all for a box of kibble. This, my friend, is time you will not get back. Make up for lost time. Every Nextel phone has a built-in walkie-talkie, so things get done faster. Sign up now and get 10,000 minutes a month. That's 4,000 walkie-talkie minutes, 1,000 anytime minutes, and 5,000 night and weekend minutes, long distance included. All for just $54.99 a month. And now the i60C with speakerphone is just $49.99. Trade up to Nextel. Bring your number. Call 800-NEXTEL-9, go to Nextel.com, or visit a store near you. Nextel. Done. Offers end February 1st, 2004. One-year agreement required. $200 early termination. Account setup fees, taxes, charges, and other restrictions apply. Local number portability available in select areas. Phones by Motorola. Legal disclaimer? Done.
By crikey, we've been hunting down an unbeatable deal on Chevrolets, especially the ultimate utility vehicle, the Avalanche, and the unique Trailblazer.
Steve, better be careful. There are some man-eating dealers out there.
Terry's right. If I'm not careful, I could get bit right in my wallet by one of those snakes. That's why I'm going to Joe Pinion Chevrolet, the unbeatable dealer.
That's right. Joe Pinion Chevrolet is the unbeatable dealer with 9 glorious acres of vehicles.
Plus, they'll beat any price and get a load of this. They even have the Honda find 2003 Chevy Blazer, plenty in stock and ready for immediate delivery.
Watch out, Steve! Other dealers only claim to give the best service, but at Joe Pinion Chevrolet, they stand by their word.
Here we are. Isn't it gorgeous? Joe Pinion Chevrolet in Southfield where Telegraph meets 696, across from the Town 12 Mall.
Good job, Steve!
Check this out. Joe Pinion Chevrolet, the unbeatable dealer. 1-866-CHOW-1111. That's 866-CHOW-1111.
Chevrolet and American Revolution. You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
All right, thank you very much. I think what I'm going to do, because I was trying a little new tact here, I don't know if it's going to work, but introducing a couple of subjects and asking you for your response. Well, we're saying that Bush's poll numbers are sinking, and well, they should. Only 30% say, well, let me put it the other way, 70% say that Bush is more interested in protecting the interests of large corporations, and less than 40% have confidence in his ability to make the right economic decisions. 51% of us now say the war against Iraq, the war in occupation particularly, is not worth the cost now that we have 500 American GIs dead, thousands wounded. Bush also planning to spend $1.5 billion of our money for the promotion of marriage among young poor people. Promotion of marriage among poor people. $1.5 billion of our tax dollars. Ain't that sweet? Martin Luther King Day is tomorrow, and marches in both Southfield and Detroit. Looking for something else here, but here, this just came in as well. Let me see who sent this. John sent this into Call Talk. Yes, at yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The 14 defining characteristics of fascism. I'm not going to read them all. Powerful and continuing nationalism. Fascist symbols tend to make constant use of patriotic mottos, slogans, symbols, songs, and other paraphernalia. This had to do with looking at Hitler's Germany, Mussolini's Italy, Franco's Spain, several Latin American regimes. I'm going to miss some of them. Identification of enemies, scapegoats as a unifying cause, supremacy of the military, controlled mass media, obsession with national security. These are the 14 defining characteristics of fascism. Religion and government intertwined. Corporate power is protected. Labor power suppressed. Disdain for intellectuals in the arts. Fascist nations tend to promote and tolerate open hostility to higher education and academia. Obsession with crime and punishment. Rampant cronyism. Rampant cronyism. That's how you take care of your buddies. And corruption. Fraudulent elections. These are a number of the 14 defining characteristics of fascism. This was in the magazine Free Inquiry, spring 2003. And whether it was this, what, Frank Zappa used to sing, it can't happen here. All right. Peter Werby at your service here, although some of you don't think that's the case, do you? Still, call me up. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Pete, what's going on? Listen, I just want to talk to you about some of the things you mentioned at the beginning of the show regarding political elites versus the average man like you and myself, Pete. Really, I think you're definitely on the right track there. I think political elites in this country, or anywhere for that matter, just seek to further their cause, further their wealth, further their power, and to, you know, subvert the rights of the average man. I think it goes one step farther in my belief, though, Pete, that... you know, it doesn't matter to me whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats that are in office. I think it's political elites as a whole, and that there's really not going to be much you can do about it. And then you got into the television and things like that, and I think that's one of our biggest problems today. Nobody's reading. Nobody's questioning. We all sit there. We let the media wash over us. We don't have any response to it. We don't question enough. So they get to walk all over us and impose their will upon us. So I think that is one thing, you know, give them the circuses, you know, entertain the people.
Yeah, it used to be, what, Roman Empire, they said, maintained itself by bread and circuses. We don't even get any bread. We just get circuses.
Right, exactly. And, you know, in the end, you know, that got to such an extent that the Roman people got their circuses to the point, I think they had 174 holidays in the year at one point.
Really?
They voted themselves a free lunch to the point where they could not sustain themselves anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it gets out of hand, and you know, I think that's one of our biggest problems today. Like I say, I mean, let's go to the moon. You know, spend a few trillion there.
Yeah. Well, let me just say something about Tweedledee, and actually, in this case, it was Tweedledee and Tweedledummer. Although I don't wonder who was actually dumber, since the Democrats let the election be stolen from them. But in any event, I think it's important to, you know, that George W. Bush is denied a second term. On the other hand, I don't think it'll fundamentally solve our problems. And every change in American history worthy of the name came about from the ground up. Mass movements of people saying we're not going to tolerate a given particular situation anymore, whether it's domination by England or, you know, slavery or whatever. And unless there is a movement for renewal, if we have a negative movement that the only thing that unites us is getting rid of George W. Bush, and everything's going to be solved if we get Howard Diener or Wesley Clark or, you know, whoever in, John Edwards, you know, this is such an illusion. I mean, it gives us a little breathing space, hopefully. But, you know, sometimes you put in the, you know, what you think is the lesser of the two evils, and it winds up worse than you thought. You know, that old, you know, from the Who song, say goodbye to the old boss, say hello to the new boss.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Hey, that reminds me. I've been getting a lot of email from conservative men, and used to, for a while, just getting all this, you know, you suck, and that, you know, like that. I mean, like that hurts my feelings. What is up with that? You know, I just see all capital letters, and, you know, Europe, just delete. They write back. And I never open anything, by the way. If you try to send me stuff from a remailer, I'm not even going to bother to explain what that's all about. I don't even read it, because I know you don't have the courage to send it, you know, under your own email. But some guy wrote me and said, that my inability to identify notable public figures showed what a loser I was, because I didn't know who Donna Brazile was, if that's even how you say her name. I thought she was a movie star. She was connected, one of the judges with the MoveOn.org anti-Bush ad. If you don't know, I don't. This is me trying to explain everything could take us forever. Go to my website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. Anyways, MoveOn.org had this this wonderful competition with 1,500 videos, 30-second anti-Bush ads, and Donna Brazile was one of them. I didn't know who the hell she was. So I'm dumb, right? I got to know who's who in the Gore campaign. I mean, I don't care. Those aren't the issues or the individuals that interest me. Then at one point, I couldn't think of Wesley Clark's first name. I just had, you know, can I say it now? I guess you can say all this stuff on, they say it on television, brain fart, right? I couldn't think of Clark's first name. And then it came to me about, you know, a minute and a half later. I'm listening to the drug addict, you know, Rush. Why do you think they call him Rush? And he calls him Leslie Clark. He says, or Wesley, or whatever the hell his name is. So, you know, this fan of this guy who's probably going to be doing some hard time. I know, he's not going to be doing any. You know, he's multimillionaires don't go to jail. Or rarely. Maybe some of those Enron guys will. He couldn't think of me either. Anyways, back to our phones. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
How you doing?
Doing good.
You might want to put a thing on. I've been hearing about the American War College has totally trashed Bush's handling of Iraq and the war on terrorism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put that on your website.
I think I have it there. I got so much on there. Everybody, I don't know. You ever been to my website?
I don't have a computer. I'm
good
sort
for
of a Luddite that way.
Good for you.
I still write with a fountain pen.
Fountain pen. No one will know what the hell that even is. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, here it is on my website. Even the Army thinks Bush's lying war was a mistake. From the Washington Post.
That's not the Army. That's the Army's graduate school. That's where professional officers go, you know, when they're furthering their career. That's like their master's and PhD program.
I mean, it is actually amazing that you'd have one of our callers earlier just trying to defend this war based on weapons of mass destruction, where here the Army War College, in a scathing new report, broadly criticizes the Bush administration's handling of the war on terrorism, accusing it of taking a detour into a quote unnecessary war in Iraq and pursuing a quote unrealistic quest against terrorism that may lead to U.S. wars with states that pose no serious threat. Case closed.
Not to mention destroying our image. I like the Onion's headline when Bush's war begins.
What was it?
U.S. begins Operation Pee Off Planet.
I love it. Thank you very much. Don't get a computer. All right.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye now. I mean, maybe that is even worth going back over. I mean, you're welcome to your opinion. And when I hear people that still are saying this war makes sense, these are simply loyal citizens of the empire who get tears in their eyes as they wave their little flag as the grand leader goes by. These are the authoritarian personalities of our nation that have no concept of being a democratic personality, small d, nothing to do with the party, that know that there has to be full public discussion, that they know that elites should not rule us. But that's not what, that's not what these folks are all about. Well, I've lost that. I wanted to read that again. Where the hell was that? This was from the Army War College. All right, I'll find it in a minute. You have every right to say, no, I don't believe them. But what are your proofs against them? The Army War College said this was an unnecessary war, a detour on the war against terrorism that may bring us into conflict with states that aren't any threat. Now we'll go back for it, because that's essentially what they said. What are your proofs? Well, I saw on Fox News that, 313-298-WRIF. Hi, this is Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter. This is John from Ferndale.
Hi, John.
Hey, I'm calling about the moon mission, Mars mission proposed by Bush.
Sure.
Short term, I'm sure, as you've already alluded to, that it's just a political smoke screen to divert attention from the problems that we're having in the country.
Right.
You know, so Bush can get reelected, of course. But really, the long-term thing is a little scientific, and I'm going to throw it out there, but I've been reading about what potential uses the moon could have if there's a moon base up there. Well, from what I understand, the sun deposits solar rays onto the moon's surface, and a helium-3 is put into the soil. And if you're able to go up there, mine this material, bring it back to the Earth, supposedly you can create a fusion reaction that will last for an entire year. 3 tons of this stuff, maybe a shuttle's worth.
Mm-hmm.
Bring it back to the United States, and you can run the whole United States 1 year, which sounds very encouraging if that was like our source for our energy needs in the future. But the thing is that if Bush gets reelected, he's going to have all his buddies locked into that thing from here till God knows when. You know, when the oil crisis comes down and we run out of oil, they're going to have them, his cronies in place.
Well, sure. Let me just.
I know that was a lot of stuff. But
yeah. Well, no, that's fine. Well, you know, the first victim of this, of course, is the Hubble space shuttle. I mean, a lot of people like just the idea because they think, oh, this is great because, it's just the stuff that science fiction is made of. But the Hubble Space Telescope will be allowed to degrade and eventually become useless as NASA changes focus to President Bush's plans to send humans to the moon, Mars, and beyond. And so they're canceling all space shuttle servicing missions to Hubble. And we'd certainly find out a lot more about the universe through Hubble than we will towards going to the moon. But here, this is, again, at AmericanProgress.org. I think you can just go there, AmericanProgress.org. Halliburton actively pushing for Mars funding. And guess who was one of the big people inside of the administration to get Bush to announce a program of going to Mars?
Dick Cheney,
the ex-CEO of Halliburton. And according to the Oil and Gas Journal, Halliburton scientist Steve Streich pointed out why a Mars program would be so lucrative for Halliburton. He says, quote, "A Mars exploration program presents an unprecedented opportunity for the industry and that it warrants the support of both government and industry leaders." Yeah, well, there it all is.
Yep.
And I'll just bore you with one other little detail. I say bore you because this stuff isn't sexy, you know. But I was talking last week about this economic concept called military Keynesianism. Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, was an English economics professor who said that during the Depression, that the only way capitalism could continue, and it didn't look like it had a good future, you know, 70 years ago or so, they said was through massive government spending that would what they called prime the pump. So what we have in this society, though, is this massive government spending on what? Militarism and crap like this. And who's paying for it? Well, if you pay taxes, John, you do.
And I.
So that's where it's all coming from. So this is what's making the economy, this is what's giving the economy its uptick. One of the two things. First off is military spending and ideas that they're going to spend like, billions to go to the moon and $1.5 billion to tell poor people how to keep their marriage intact. And the other thing is massive personal debt. And this is why the International Monetary Fund is so worried about the United States economy under Bush. That's why they're saying that the Bush policies threatens the stability of the global economy. That's scary. Scary. Thank you, John.
Thanks
for joining me at 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, and hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Who's this?
This is Sue. One of the things that really bothers me is the society's ignorance about the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't realize that our government does torture people. They're probably brainwashing Saddam Hussein and giving him drugs, GHB, etc. And he'll probably come up with, oh, he sold the weapons of mass destruction to Syria or some other easy-to-conquer country. You know,
now, you're onto something, Sue. I don't know the details of it or how we can be sure about it. But what I was going to say was that it's going to be extraordinarily curious what Saddam Hussein is going to see when he stands in front of a panel, a judge and jury. And I mean, what he's going to say could be extraordinarily damning to Bush's father, and I mean to George himself. I suspect that he will not stand trial before the U.S. election.
Well, they did have a month to work on him.
Yeah.
And they do brainwash people. They do shock people's brains. I don't know if you've known anyone in the FBI.
Never knew anybody.
But they get away with murder. They covered up my husband's murder.
Hmm.
And it's the big secret that we actually do abuse people, torture people, and they have nobody to answer to.
Well, when you're making the rules, I mean, I know that there's a number of U.S. soldiers now, either a couple of them were, I think, convicted even of mistreating Iraqi prisoners. In fact, it was Saddam Hussein's notorious prison, I don't have the name in front of me, is being utilized as an American prison for Iraqi suspects. And the American or the International Red Cross expresses grave concerns about conditions there as well as Guantanamo. I thank you very much for joining us. We will be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this. This is another Riff Rock concert.
Calling all hell raisers. The American Badass brings it to Detroit. Are you ready?
Tickets are on sale now. Available at the Palace Box Office and all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge 248-645-6666. Online at cc.com or palacenet.com.
Be sure and pick up Kid Rock's new self-titled CD.
I feel like
if it's gonna be big and it's gonna be bad, then it's got to be
Kid Rock with special guest Puddle of Mud.
Do you feel like half the man you used to be? Do you feel tired and irritable? Are you losing your sex drive? If so, you could have low testosterone.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. Testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now you can boost your testosterone naturally. Introducing Testostazine, the powerful new testosterone-boosting system I developed for men who are starting to feel their age. Testostazine supports your body's ability to produce testosterone the way you did when you were younger, so you can restore your energy, youthful sex drive, and staying power. Testosterone keeps a man energetic and sexually confident. You can feel that way no matter what your age. Testostazine can help.
Call now for your risk-free confidential trial of testosterone. Call 1-800-807-8108. 1-800-807-8108. Guaranteed to work for you or your money back. Call 1-800-807-8108. Results will vary.
You get more for your money.
More for your money.
At Alamport.
Go!
It's time to get more for your money when you go to Along Ford's January Sales Extravaganza. You saw what you want at the auto show. Well, now through Monday, Along is not only moving them out at the lowest prices of the year, you'll also drive away with a free remote car starter. That's right, it may be freezing outside, but at Along, the deals are hot, and you'll get your vehicle upgraded with a free remote car starter. Plus, that's on top of your free service loaner and Along's exclusive $2,000 value package. Plus, right now, Along can put you in a brand new 2004 Explorer with no money down for only $199 a month. That's with no money down. You'll also find rebates of over $4,700. But hurry, these offers end Monday. For details, call 800-801-LONG. Along Ford, your Ford dealer forever.
Drive away in style at Along Ford.
East 8 Mile at Shaner.
The Beatles are back at the Max. It's a British invasion unlike any other. It's a classical mystery tour. A special tribute to the Beatles, featuring original members of the Broadway sensation Beatlemania and the Detroit Symphony DTE Energy Foundation Pops, only at the Max M. Fisher Music Center.
The Max is just, it's amazing.
It's incredible.
Spectacular.
The Detroit Symphony Orchestra has never sounded better.
A Day in the Life, Yesterday, Penny Lane, and more. All your favorite Fab Four hits in a fabulous four-day extravaganza.
If you haven't seen The Max, you got to do it. It really is awesome.
Don't miss A Classical Mystery Tour, a tribute to the Beatles, Thursday, January 22nd through Sunday the 25th with the Detroit Symphony DTE Energy Foundation Pops. Call 313-576-5111. That's 313-576-5111 or go to DetroitSymphony.com.
You're logged on at WRIF.com. We'll get back to more Rip Rock in just a moment.
Hello, how are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We tried calling this guy, got this woman, and she made the mistake of hanging up on us.
Why'd you hang up?
I have company and I am busy.
Oh, you say usually when people hang up, I don't know if you're new, if you just get citizenship, usually people say goodbye before they hang up the telephone.
I told you I had to go.
I remember you were laughing about the erection, but...
No, I said I had to go, no, and people, I'm hanging up. Goodbye.
People, usually, yeah, say goodbye. Oh, wait, that's good. You learn.
Yeah, okay.
She didn't have any company. What is she talking about?
Company.
Liar.
Yeah, I know. People lie on a...
Let's call back and say we're a caterer. And there's nobody over here, they'll say, liar!
Let me tell you what's really going to happen. You're going to call up as a so-called caterer, and she's going to be, I just talked to you, I said goodbye.
Hating me for not being able to immediately remember the first name of Wesley Clark. Roy, who's listening in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, says, remember when Shrub was running for president? He couldn't even name the president for life of Pakistan, our wonderful ally. That was a trick question, he said. Being dictator for life, Shrub has probably given him a nickname by now. That's right. Sarah, listening in East Lansing. Is it your alma mater if you didn't graduate? I don't think so. That's where I went, though. She says, I missed the intro, so I may have missed the part, but who are you endorsing as the Democratic nominee? I was leaning towards Dean, but I'm worried about him winning in a general election for obvious reasons, which are what? I don't know. What's your take? I haven't been paying that much attention to it all. I hate to say it, but, just get somebody in there that can beat Bush. This is Neil in Albuquerque, and... He says, I was telling people not to watch any important speech, particularly by Bush, because then, you just get kind of mesmerized by the fact that it's on television and the trappings and the power that exudes. Neil writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I have difficulty watching the Shrub on TV for more than a few minutes at a time. I have, however, found that Bush's lies become transparent when one watches him with the sound turned off. Try it, even for a few moments, he says. Huh, do I have one more? Stephen Sterling Heights, he had the whole thing, that the Universal, about the draft, the Universal National Service Act of 2003, introduced January 7, 2003, declares that it is the obligation of every U.S. citizen between 18 and 26 to perform a two-year period of national service unless exempted, either as an active or reserve component of the armed forces or in a civilian capacity that promotes national defense. So this won't come in before the 2004 election. This is, you know, they don't have enough people in the army. And we're only attacking and occupying two countries right now. And these wackos that, what are they, let me see, you can test my memory. Richard Pearl and David Frum, who have this book like Conquering Evil. So these conquistadors, these crusaders, you know, they've got a lot of other, you know, countries in their gun sights. And these are the guys that essentially developed the agenda beginning as long ago as 1998 to invade and occupy Iraq, to invade and occupy Afghanistan. Or some of this, what do we call it, Pipelinistan, in terms of Afghanistan and stuff like that. All right, let's go back to our phones. Please join me, 313-298-WRIF, email calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and website peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. At 1 o'clock, I said we were going to talk about gay marriage on my website. Well, I'll have an interview with a guy that's written a book about gay marriage. Kind of interesting. Very interesting. What am I saying? Kind of interesting. Hi, Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Pete. Bill, how you doing?
Hi, Bill.
Pete, I've been in manufacturing all my life, and I used to be one of those conservative kind of guys.
Uh-huh.
But let me tell you, that my view has changed quite a bit over the last 5 years. They're selling us out.
What did it?
I'm looking at how it's affected my business and how everything's going over to Asia and everything's going out of the country. We're going to lose a manufacturing base.
Sure. What do you mean, going to?
It's gone.
Yeah.
It's pretty much gone. We're still hanging in there, but let me tell you, it's a lot tougher than it used to be.
I can imagine.
And, you know, it's, you look at the whole situation, all these conservatives now, they have a little bit of money, all these accountants and all these things that call them, quote, conservatives. When the rest of the manufacturing base is eroded and all these little companies that they take care of to make out their little thousands of dollars are gone, where are they going to stand out? Then they're going to start crying wolf.
Yeah. Yeah, let me see. The reason I'm trying to get these. Bush, during Bush's deal, the manufacturing sector has lost 2.8 million jobs since August 2000.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And all this is an economy of greed for the large corporations. The only ones that are making out is General Motors and everybody else. They set up Delphi plants, everything over in Europe, over in Asia. Even one of my major customers just bought a plant over in China over the holiday.
Well, they're even worried about the big three. I mean, the big three really isn't the big three. Who's the big three? Toyota, Honda, what's the third one? Mitsubishi?
Well, they all have their fingers. It's an intermingling now because they all have the General Motors, the Fords, and that all have investments in these corporations. They're still reaping money back. They're still driving their stock price up, and that's all they're worried about is the stock price. If we don't take care of our own backyard, it's going to be gone.
You got it. Absolutely, Bill. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining me at 313-298-WRIF. Hi, Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Okay. Hi, Peter, longtime listener. My name is Kevin, and I'm really not very politically inclined, but I listen to your show a lot, and I don't really watch much TV. But you said earlier somebody was talking about the oil, and but what I want to know is I've done my own little study, and over the last 100 years, we've used so much oil. My question is, how much oil do we have left?
That's a good question. I mean, they're talking about oil production peaking. In other words, that we're going to soon be at the point where we're going to definitively be running out. And
what happens at that point?
You ever heard that thing about Native Americans used to say, I can't remember what generation, think in terms of the sixth generation ahead or 12th generation, something like that. They just think, you know, for quarterly profits. And after them, who cares?
So in other words, it could be 25 years, but as long as it's at least that long, then they're good and screw my children.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because my kids, you know, I've got a teenager, my son will be 13 on Tuesday, in 3 years, you know, he'll have a car, but over 100 years, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, by the time he's 25 or 35, maybe the oil might be all gone. How close are we?
The
Earth is only so big, and there's only so much oil.
There's a finite amount. I mean, right now, I mean, we're not at risk of running.
Are we recycling it enough?
No, of course not. Nothing. We're not conserving it enough. We're not doing anything that a smart people or culture or nation would do. I mean, the United States is now, I mean, its policies to support, you know, its corporate... you know, it's corporate interests in oil are meddling, for instance, in the country. There's a country called Georgia, which was part of the Soviet Union, that they just, you know, engineered an overthrow of a particular government there. That the whole idea of bringing natural gas, oil, and what have you through these countries, I mean, it's very complex. And it's all, you know, behind the scenes. You don't ever read about it. I mean, you have to be, I mean, you have to go to an extraordinary effort. You can't go about your business and think you're going to see this, because, I mean, I'm even surprised that the Detroit News and Free Press, as I was saying, had substantive issues on the front page. Job loss, education, worry Michigan voters. That's the headline today. Usually it's sports or that Chevy is introducing another new car. And if this country had policy that was decided in terms of the majority of us, the people, the constituents, the people that this country and its form of government was set up for, rather than the elites that rule it, we'd understand there was an energy crisis, because oil causes wars, it causes pollution. It's, in general, a bad source of energy. And what we would declare would be an energy crisis, and then we would have to start doing some of the things, Kevin, that you said. We'd have to start conservation, but most of all, we would look for alternative sources of energy.
And part of my question too, what would the, let's just say today we ran out of oil, is there an alternative that they're working on now, or are we just absolutely going back to the Stone Age?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if we go back to the Stone Age, I don't think it's going to be, because suddenly, you know, it's like pulling up to the gas pump and there's nothing there. I mean, when the oil reserves begin to run out, I mean, that's one of the many reasons that Bushco attacked Iraq, is because they're sitting on the largest oil reserves in the world. And the United States wanted to be able to control it, both in terms of, you know, some concern for the economy, but mostly for the economy in terms of the corporations, the energy corporations that want to control it all. Because, for instance, the Iraq Constitution says that foreign companies cannot take profits out of Iraq. So what did Bush do? Bush just had the ruler of Iraq, the dictator of Iraq, Paul Bremer, make a new rule saying this is, you know, we're not doing this anymore. You know, now we can let foreign companies read, you know, particularly U.S. companies and companies, other companies that have U.S. investors, go into Iraq, set up oil extraction companies, and take the profits out of Iraq.
Well, I don't see the problem. I don't see why they shouldn't be, other countries shouldn't be able to profit. I mean,
well, wait a minute. But whether you think so or not, an occupying, under the rules of international warfare, an occupying power can't come in and change the laws for its benefit. I mean, you may or may, you know, you can say they should or shouldn't, but the fact is that the United States invaded Iraq in part for oil. And they're not going to be forestalled by anything like international law. I mean, they weren't dissuaded from attacking Iraq, you know, in violation of international laws. There's no reason they're not going to attempt to get the rewards as well. But you may remember before the invasion, when people started saying this is going to cost tens of billions of dollars, and it's cost somewhere, depending on whose figures, between $90 billion and $130 billion already. You know, you and me paying for it. But people like Rumsfeld, when you think about it, every single thing these guys said was an absolute lie. One of the things that they said was that Iraq's oil would pay for the invasion and occupation. Hasn't done it.
Mm-mm.
No. Well, it's a major concern. There's a lot of stuff out there, you know, books. I'm trying to think of this one that I... well, listen up. While we're talking, I'll look at my website and see if this book that I... Damn. Actually, Kevin, do you have... I'm just fumbling around here, trying to remember and trying to get my web page up.
Okay.
I'll do that. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for calling us. All right. It's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hi. This is Louie. I just wanted to bring up, I don't know if anyone's noticed the violent attacks on labor Bush has been pushing lately, trying to, like, stop the overtime pay and putting, I think his name's Richard Scalia, as an attorney for the labor in the office, who's a known union hater. So it's like putting a Ku Klux Klan member to represent the NAACP, basically. But outside of that, though, there's just been no notification of labor. It's really sad because in this country, labor built, you know, labor is a reason this country exists today. I mean, I'm a laborer myself. I'm only 22, but I mean, I've been doing rough carpentry for a good 3 years, and now I'm working in for Fisher Dynamics, which is an auto. You know, they make manual recliners for mm-hmm. the GM and stuff like that. But recently, we just started trying to get a union in, and the attacks that the companies put on us—they've gone so far as to threaten to fire people and all kinds of stuff. And sure. Most of it's illegal, you know.
Right.
And I know this for a fact because I was a VOC, and we were, you know, talking back and forth with the UAW that was trying to help us out.
But what's a VOC?
Voluntary Organizing Committee.
Oh, okay. Right.
You know, we basically volunteer ourselves to try to organize a union.
You're absolutely right. Why anybody, any working person, why anybody other than a very, very wealthy person and a very, very wealthy person with no conscience would back Bush's policies is way beyond me. One thing, though, it's coming our way, though. You may have heard me read this earlier. 70% of Americans just polled say that Bush is more interested in protecting the interests of large corporations than ordinary Americans. But this attack on overtime is another big giveaway to major corporations, his buddies. And Scalia, are you sure? It's Richard Scalia? Are you sure about the first name?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I think it was the son of Scalia.
Yeah. There you go, because this is the part of the racket. This is the Labor Department that was supposed to represent labor. The Labor Secretary is anti-labor. Everybody in it is anti-labor. A better analogy, although yours was a good one, would be if you went to the United States Commission on Civil Rights and appointed, segregationists. That would be equal. I mean, I'm surprised that he hasn't tried that. You may know that Bush just appointed a judge that had been rejected by the Congress, this guy named Pickering, who is far right wing. It was a pro segregationist earlier in his life, and this is the kind of thing that Bush does. He goes down to Atlanta, to lay a wreath at the tomb of Martin Luther King. He's the first president since this was established not to have been invited by the King Center, so he invited himself. He was met by about 1,000 people yelling at him to go home, and people knew what a disgrace this was. So Martin Luther King, this champion of the poor, white and black, is visited by this wealthy ne'er-do-well who the only reason he's even in the office is because of his rich daddy on any number of levels. And after that, he goes to a $2,000 a plate dinner and raises another $1.5 million or $2 million for his already swollen re-election coffers. I mean, it is just a disgrace. And then the next day, he appoints this awful right-wing guy as a judge.
Yeah, well, the other thing that really bugs me, too, which is, like, obviously, I mean, like, from what I've seen in my own work is obviously what's wrong with the entire company, or country, I'm sorry, is that these people, like, they just totally bent backwards. The company said a few words, made a few threats, and they just dropped like flies. And it didn't make sense because they got the Constitution, right? You know, the right to organize, the right to the freedom of speech. They had all that behind them, and they just, like, they're dumb, that's all. I mean, it's difficult to try to represent. I don't want to talk bad about, you know, the people I work with or anything like that. But, I mean, they just bent backwards.
Now, I'll tell you what, it's very disheartening, and I know a lot of people, particularly in the UAW organizing department, and initially they get great enthusiasm. Most workers say, I think like 3/4 of workers say that they would join a union if they had the opportunity. So when organizers go into a plant or, you know, even now offices and what have you, they get great initial response, and then the corporation, the company, starts making the kind of threats that they do that, you know, that are illegal under the National Labor Relations Act, and, you know, on and on and on. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's the old thing, I have to tell you, that, it, you know, the old saying that, you know, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Now, that's interesting. That fits here, doesn't it? The bird in the hand is the job we have now. Even though you're being exploited, you're getting bum wages, you're not getting any representation, you know, your boss is a total, or supervisor form is a total a-hole, and you have no grievance procedure, your health benefits suck and everything like that, at least it's a job. But when the boss comes around and starts threatening to get rid of you, well, all of a sudden people, the way you put it, was bend over. They get scared.
Yeah, well, what made me mad the most, though, is that they didn't even, you know, originally we're supposed to pass out cards, people sign them. When we turn those cards in, after we get a certain percentage, that pretty much tells the UAW and I think they talked to somebody in, you know, the state or something like that, that they will allow us a right to vote. You know, there's like a, I think a 60-day period,
right,
where we basically campaign. We're allowed to campaign for a union, and it's a total democratic thing where we campaign and say this is why you should vote for a union, and the company can do their own stuff, and at the end of those 60 days, everybody casts a vote, and, you know, that the decision is made. But those people wouldn't even, they wouldn't even give themselves the right to vote, you know, for a union.
You're right. Well, without going on, they're afraid. And until the people have the self-confidence that we can launch our end of the class war. In other words, the employers, the corporations, the wealthy have been waging class war against the middle class and the working class for the last 30 years, and they have had victory after victory after victory, whereas we've been beaten back time after time. So if it's class war that they want, you know, we should be launching that in a manner that our grandfathers did in the 1930s. That's what's necessary, or we're going to wind up to be a third world country.
Yeah, really, especially if they keep selling our jobs out, too.
All right, I got to move along, so thank you so much.
All right, yeah, thanks a lot.
I appreciate it. Hey, good luck with it, and don't get discouraged, because sometimes, you know, people at the end of things will surprise you. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, bye-bye now. Continuing on, hi, Peter Werby with you. I didn't press any phone button, so everybody's saying, is he talking to me? I'm saying everybody in general. Hello, thank you for joining me at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. We'll be launching an interview with our guest. Let me see. I don't even have his name in front of me, and I just did it. Oh, yeah, David Moats, M-O-A-T-S. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial page director of the Rutland, Vermont Register. And he wrote a book about gay marriage, a big struggle over whether to have gay marriage in Vermont. And he talks about the consequences of it. Howard Dean was governor at the time as well, so there's that little wrinkle to it. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. It's Mike out of Harper Woods. How you doing?
Good, Mike. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you. I was just wondering, have you ever watched Charlie Rose?
No.
You know who he is?
I know who he is. I've never watched him. No.
Well, he's on PBS at night.
Right.
Late night. I think he's on at about midnight or 12:30. Michael Moore was on this week.
Uh-huh.
With him on Tuesday. And they were talking about the Bush. Michael Moore was talking about the Bush lies and deceits. And I'm just curious if you hadn't seen it, or I'll just let you know what happened. But,
no, tell me. Tell me, and I'm sure.
Moore was into... he'd been talking for about 20 minutes, and he started talking about the Bin Laden connection to the Bushes, I guess, which goes back about, what, 25 years?
Yep.
And he just got into some, started getting some good information, and all of a sudden the tape was cut. And it just went blank. And then
really?
This other guy came on, Dentley, I think it is, and he was talking about some other book, and it was, I had no idea. Me and my wife were watching, and I don't even know what this guy's talking about. And they went on for about, probably for about 20 or 25 minutes. And then Michael Moore showed up again. Of course, this is all taped previously. I don't know if it's a date earlier in the day or a day before, but Michael Moore came back on about 10 seconds and just said a few words about Bush, and then it was it. And the show was over.
Well, let me tell you a couple of things. Michael Moore's next film, from what I understand, is going to be the connection between the Bushes and the Bin Ladens, and also between the Bush family and the Nazi Party during the 1930s, to the extent where the part of the Bush fortune was... Geez, I've seen this so many times. Anyways, there was a very direct...
Bush's grandfather.
Yeah, exactly. Also, let's see, in Pembroke, New Hampshire, Wesley Clark suggested Saturday that questions remain about Bush's Vietnam-era service in the Texas Air National Guard, but the retired general stopped short of endorsing a statement by actor-director Michael Moore that Bush was a deserter. Here's what Moore said to an enthusiastic applause at a packed rally in a high school gymnasium for Wesley Clark. I want to see that debate, the general versus the deserter.
Yeah.
Now, if you think that's harsh, people, if you've listened to this program before, you know, you go to AWOLBush.com, AWOLBush.com, and if you can prove that the man was not AWOL, he was gone for a year, and hence a deserter, you can get a lot of money from the people offering.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah.
Michael Moore is so cool. He's right on about everything.
Yeah.
And he gets all his facts. I mean, everything that he talks about, he can back up. He's got facts to back himself up.
He does.
Up.
By
and
the
he,
way...
And,
yeah, go ahead.
You know, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that Michael Moore's book, the latest one, Dude, Where's My Country, is now the number two bestseller in the United States again. And Al Franken's book, Lies and the Lying Liars That Tell 'Em, or something like that, is the number one book again. Yeah, yeah.
Well, Michael Moore's books, most of his books have been number bestsellers.
Sure, and this one as well. This one as well. Now, a number of people have been saying, why the hell would Michael Moore back Wesley Clark when there are people that are much more progressive than him? Everybody from Howard Dean I'm blocking on his name, Dennis Kucinich. And I think what Michael Moore is envisioning is someone who could easily beat Bush the easiest. And in envisioning the general versus the deserter. But, you know, probably Clark would be, you know, wouldn't bring it up even. Why the hell he wouldn't, I don't know.
Yes. One other thing I know you got callers. One other thing I wanted to ask you, too, is what happened to all the millions that the U.S. Army has confiscated over in Iraq so far, especially from the sons of Saddam Hussein, for Saddam Hussein himself, and they didn't capture him, but the Kurds?
Kurds captured him, yeah.
Yeah, they captured him a week before or whatever, and then handed him over to the United States. But the United States made it look like they captured him out of the hole.
Right, that sure went away quick.
I know, isn't it?
Well,
then,
you know what?
What happened to all those? What happened to all those millions that
well,
they're finding?
Well, they
where
probably.
Did they go?
They probably, recycle them into, some of the costs. Like I said earlier, the United States is picking up the costs for tens of thousands, maybe more, maybe hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. All right, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Santa. I am having a block. Let me see. I have to be able to do this. Santa Cruz, California. It's Billy. Hey, Billy, thanks for joining us.
Peter, you know, when you get our age, we shouldn't be allowed to do radio. We can't see. We can't remember.
Huh? What do you say? What's the choice of vegetables?
Peas.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, where's my free speech?
Right here.
Well, not for much longer. You know, one of these crazy congressmen is trying to make a law about what we can and can't say on the radio. You know, up to now it's sort of been just enforced by FCC fines, but not a law from Congress.
Like what? I mean, they're concerned about, did you watch, you're out in California, so what is it there now? 9:30. Did
night
you,
time, you know, when
did you
started.
Watch the, what is it, the L word? Is that what that show was?
I haven't watched it yet, but I intend to. It's about lesbians, right?
It's about lesbians, yeah.
Well, of course I'll tune in. I'm healthy.
I wonder about, Bush says he's against gay marriage. Or tell me, here, let me read you Bush's quote. Tell me what you make of this. If this is George W. Bush, if necessary, I will support a constitutional amendment which would honor marriage between a man and a woman, codify that, and will. The position of this administration is that whatever legal arrangements people want to make, they're allowed to make so long as it's embraced by the state or does start at the state level. What is that? What did he say?
He said, you know, I've got to secure my base, so I've got to make these noises that are anti-homosexual so that the right wing sticks with me.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Literally, what did he say, or what does it mean?
I don't know. Well, I don't know. That's what it means. I don't know what the hell he said. I'm looking at Newsweek of December 1st, 2003, and there are my good friends right in the front page, Betsy and Gail, hugging one another because this was when that sodomy statute was overturned.
Texas.
And, yeah, and they're women, so, they, you know, wasn't... But it, just look at these... Beautiful smiles on their face.
That's what the right wing doesn't want to see, happy homosexuals.
Yeah, and then they have these other people that are another little photo of stop homosexual marriage, and then it's just these people. But wait a minute, doesn't everybody love lesbianism now? Isn't that the newest thing?
Well, we've always loved lesbianism, and that's sort of the big lie, you know?
What?
It's only the guy stuff that we find disgusting.
Well, maybe that could be the deal, that they would only allow women to marry.
Well, you know what? The fact is that I was just talking to my cousin who's gay, and he's saying, look, we obviously just want the rights. We don't have to call it marriage. And, of course, I'm more radical than him, and I say, you know what? Why shouldn't you be able to call it anything you damn well please? As far as honoring the sacredness of marriage, tell that to the 50% of us heterosexuals who get divorced, who would leave our children, who don't pay our way.
Yeah.
Who's kidding who here?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, intervening in the most private affairs. I mean, I thought these conservatives wanted to get the state off of people's back, get government out of their private lives.
No. Now that they have control of government, government needs to control absolutely everything. Conservatives are people who are interested in power only and to make sure that power does not transfer out of their hands, and how that is ever best achieved is what they will say. Hey, you want to talk about liberal media for just a second?
Yeah.
So, people seem to wonder why we need a liberal network, a liberal radio network. And here's my answer to that in a nutshell. No one seems to be asking Bush any tough questions. How is that? What the hell's going on?
Well, one thing I've noticed that you know, parked in the back of newspapers has been reports of some pretty damning speeches about Bush by Ted Kennedy and by Al Gore. And one of the, when Bush speaks, when Bush, and he actually he speaks in Bush speak, but when Bush speaks, they just, you know, they say what he says, and they don't have any refutations. Now Ted Kennedy was in, you know, indicting him on every level imaginable, and interspersed almost throughout the article, beginning after the first paragraph that summarized, as newspapers do, what the article was about, there was, you know, one refutation after another from the Republican National Committee and by Tom DeLay and what have you. Same thing with Al Gore. They report his speech where he called Bush a moral coward. You know, if he would have actually, if Gore would have been this tough during the 2000 election, we wouldn't even, you know, no one would even know who George Bush was except for the father. But any event, throughout the whole article, again, they have all these other people saying Al Gore, you know, like that. So it's a whole manner in which things are presented. The media is terrified of Republicans.
And well, obviously, I mean that's the point I'm trying to make. Ultimately, the people whose job it is they're called the press corps. They're called the White House press corps. But you know, Helen Thomas is now in the back of the room somewhere because she refused to cow down, and nobody is picking up the torch in the media. Everything we were afraid of about a corporate media appears to be coming true.
Sure. Well, what it is, I guess people think when you challenge power, you go to the back of the room. Hey, Billy, thank you so much.
Hey, buddy.
Always good talking to you. Bye now.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
But Veronica's
the Stevens House, 7 p.m.
Susie's night minutes don't start till 9. So she talks to us for another, 2 hours.
I notice she's braiding your hair.
Yeah, ouch.
Here, with Sprint Unlimited night minutes start at 7 instead of 9. And they're the only ones that built their network from the ground up, and they built it right.
2 more hours? How'd you guys do it?
We just turned back time.
Introducing Unlimited night minutes starting at 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. That's 2 more hours each weeknight. With the PCS Free and Clear area-wide plan, get 1,000 anytime minutes to share between two phones for $50 a month for the first 3 months, $70 a month thereafter. With this plan, call to anywhere in the U.S. from anywhere in your extended calling area while on the Sprint nationwide PCS network. Plus, unlimited PCS to PCS calling and nationwide long distance are included. PCS from Sprint, the clear difference in wireless.
Shared plans require qualified credit. 2-year agreement required. Activation and termination fees apply. Off-network roaming and calls outside local area extra. Taxes, surcharges, and fees excluded. Not available everywhere. Network covers over 240 million people. See store for extended calling areas and details.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Hello?
Hey, Bob. What are you doing, man?
No, I'm just leaving work. Why? What's up?
You should shoot across the border and meet me at Leopard's Lounge in Windsor. Dude, they have incredible girls from all over the world. And I'm telling you, these girls are hot.
Oh, man. I gotta go across the border. I don't know.
Come on, you big baby. It's just 5 minutes from the Bridger Tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. And get this. At Leopard's Lounge, you don't even have to pay a cover charge. Ever. Plus, they even have free parking. You gotta meet me there. They have these two girls from Romania. Bro, I'm telling you, they're the friendliest girls I've ever met. Heck, all the girls at Leopard's Lounge are friendly.
Wait a minute. Did you say no cover, free parking, and women from all over the world?
Bro, that's what I've been telling you. So, are you going to meet me up at Leopard's Lounge or what?
Dude, I'm so there. I'll see you in about half an hour. And hey, if you get there before me, tell the girls I'm on my way.
You got it. I'll see you at Leopard's Lounge.
Leopard's Lounge in Royal, Windsor's number one gentleman's club. Just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. Call 1-888-653-8881 for Leopard's Lounge in Royal.
Hey, it's a new year, and it's late night, 2004. David Hall here reporting for Rock Financial with the information you need after normal business hours. Get answers to your mortgage questions right now at rockfinancial.com. Whether you're looking to refinance your existing mortgage or purchase a new home, you can find the mortgage experts online ready to help you. Rockfinancial.com has the mortgage tools you need to get you started. Log on today for information on Rock Financial products and services. Find out if refinancing makes sense for you. Use our mortgage calculators to see how much you can save on your monthly payments, or even find out how much home you can afford if you want to purchase a new home. The mortgage experts working for you overnight or anytime, even online. We're Michigan's largest mortgage company, closing nearly 100,000 satisfied clients in 2003. Get your mortgage questions answered today. Visit us online right now, rockfinancial.com. That's rockfinancial.com.
Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company and equal housing lender. Call the mortgage experts now, 800-333-ROCK.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. We're in our final segment, 1 a.m., interview with David Motes, author of Civil Wars, I think the name of... Marriage Wars, I guess the name of the book is, and it's about Vermont's attempt to deal with the Supreme Court that said you cannot ban same-sex people from marrying. And why should you? I mean, you look at this, article here, strong support is found for a ban on gay marriage. 55% of Americans favored an amendment to the Constitution that would allow marriage only between a man and a woman. What do you care if I'm speaking to one of you? What? I mean, what could you possibly care? I heard some creepy right winger. Oh yeah, it was Bill O'Reilly saying, you know, something about marrying. That wasn't a dog. Pardon me. And I'm thinking again. I've said this before. What do I care if somebody marries a dog? Here they're bringing in. Do you take this dog to be your lawful wedded wife? Arf, arf. What the hell? What do I care? I care about how people live on the planet. Am I going to be able to? I know. Need some water. Need another caller. Where are we at? Five. Thank you. Hi, WDRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Steve?
Hi.
Hi. Remember a couple of months ago, wasn't that long ago, it was supposed to be a big story where an ambassador who rubbed the Bush administration the wrong way, his wife happened to be a CIA agent, and
right.
Somebody in the Bush administration blew her cover.
That's right, a federal felony.
Right, and there was talk that the guy had committed treason by doing this and all this, and it looked like it was going to be a huge story. And then all of a sudden, overnight, every single news agency in the country dropped the story, and the whole thing was hushed up. Whatever happened with that?
Whatever happened to the investigation into September 11th? Whatever happened to Enron? I mean, you see little pieces of this now and again. But the Bush's capacity, Bushko's capacity to ignore the major stories of the last few or 3 years, to suppress them, would give Stalin a run for his money. And yeah, I have to say, at this moment, I can't even remember the names of the people involved, although this was a clear violation and an attempt to punish this man. I think his name was White, and this is still going on. There's kind of like a special prosecutor been appointed by the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, but they allowed so much time to take place, or to pass, rather, before a proper independent counsel was appointed, or a special prosecutor, I guess not an independent counsel, and that who knows what could have been done with all the evidence. Somebody in the White House blew the cover of a CIA agent, and someone ought to be, going to jail.
Yeah, and the whole thing was totally hushed up by the news media. I mean, they had a much bigger story than Monica Lewinsky ever would have been, and all of a sudden it was just like Pravda. We've got Pravda for a news agency.
You got it.
And what worries me about it is, when you lose a free press, you lose democracy. And I don't see much of a free press anymore.
Well, that's why I spend little time involved in it. I mean, I do read the New York Times every day, which is filled with, same amount of BS that a lot of other sources are, but in many ways they're pretty thorough. And if you have other sources and you kind of understand what's motivating different sectors of the control apparatus, I mean, you can utilize that. But it really is incumbent upon people, if they want to find out what's really going on, to do a little more investigating. I actually had somebody write me the other day and say that I ought to spend more time watching CNN. That was their advice to me. I mean,
well, you look at the economic news that was on CNN and a lot of other news this past week talking about the job growth and the economic. Well, they said the job growth was last month 1,000 jobs for the whole country. That was the job growth last month.
Really?
1,000 jobs. Now, if anybody has a calculator handy, that's 12,000 jobs a year. How many years or hundreds of years will it take to recoup the 3 million jobs plus that we've lost in the last 2 or 3 years?
You got it.
It's mind-boggling.
It is. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Appreciate your call. Call talkyes@yahoo.com for internet mail, 313-298-WRIF on the telephone. Hi, this is Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, this is Sean. I'm calling. Earlier you guys were talking, first of all, I'm going to let you know. I'm basically a Catholic. I'm a Republican. I'm a great Bush supporter.
Still. We respect the right of minorities to dissent. Go ahead.
Earlier you were talking about how they were talking, I believe it was, you were saying Bush was a deserter for the the war.
He was in the Air National Guard, and he took off for a year, never reported to duty.
Well, how come they're not talking about, like Mike Moore was talking about, how come he's not talking about Clinton, how he deserted the draft before trying to go into the war? How come he runs away, he doesn't even show up? No one's talking about that.
I don't think Clinton ever did that. Clinton had deferments.
That was all over the news when he was running for election, that he was a draft dodger.
Wait a minute. Now, there's a difference between the hundreds of thousands or millions of young men who were able to legally get out of the draft. Now, if you want to talk about people that avoided the draft, you have to begin right at the top of the Republican administration. There's a website called Chicken Hawks. And on that, it lists all the right-wing, Republican, conservative people that are all for every war that ever comes down the pike but managed to escape service. There's not a single one of them with, Rumsfeld, I guess, served in the Air Force. Bush scammed his way into the Texas Air National Guard because his dad was rich. Outside of that, nobody. They all got out. Rush Limbaugh had anal cysts. That's how he got out of the armed forces. But Dick Cheney said he had better things to do with his time and what have you. It's one thing to oppose a war and use what you can to get out of a draft, which to me is doesn't have any place in a free society to begin with. You say, look, I don't agree with this war. So what? You're going to take a chance to get killed and you have to go kill other people. But that aside, Bill Clinton, like tens of millions of other Americans and young people at that period, opposed the war in Vietnam. All these other characters who were in their 20s at the time and were eligible and probably should have ran down there and joined up, like Dick Cheney and the rest of them, they said, we want all you working class kids to go fight. We want all you black kids to go fight. We want all you Hispanic kids to go fight. Me, the rich white guy, I've got better things to do. So if you want to start pointing fingers at draft dodgers in Vietnam, you better start looking at the entire Republican apparatus.
I was just saying, because you had a caller a couple times ago was saying about how Bush was based.
Well, wait a minute. Don't repeat yourself. I got you said that. But what are you saying? That Bush is as bad as Clinton?
No, they're both the same. And I'm just.
So you think Clinton's pretty awful, though, right?
Yeah.
So then you think George Bush is awful.
Well, in my opinion, they're both awful because they didn't serve their country the way they're supposed to.
How about Dick Cheney? Is he awful? He scammed out of the draft, too.
I haven't heard anything about Cheney, so I can't talk about Cheney.
Well,
I haven't heard the news about Cheney. All I've heard about was Bush and Clinton. That's all I've heard about. So
okay.
I really can't say anything about both of these people. About anyone else.
Well, there is different. Listen, if you were smart and middle class and white, you could get out of the Vietnam draft very easily. It was fought essentially by the working class and by the poor. And if you were, again, if you were white and middle class, you didn't have to go. This was fought by young, the typical age, right? We've heard that before, 19-year-old white working class or African-American or Hispanic Americans. And it was easy to get out legally. In fact, a lot of people could even hire lawyers, and they could hire psychiatrists, and they could hire doctors to make sure that they didn't have to go there and fight that awful, murderous war. But Cheney, for instance, supported the war, and yet he didn't go. He let somebody else fight and die for him. Bill Clinton, at least, opposed the war. I mean, there was a great movement called draft resistance, where people fought the draft as well as a way of opposing the war. But who is beneath contempt, as far as I'm concerned, are people that want to get other people to do their fighting for him.
So there's a difference here.
Okay.
It's called, right, my parents, they're rich. I'm going to school. I'm actually graduating now, and I'm planning on getting my master's. But if the draft comes about, I'll go to the draft. I will fight for my country, because that's the way my grandfather did. My dad, he applied to the National Guard. He almost went. My uncle almost went to the Vietnam. So I'm like, I will fight for my country if I have to.
Well, they,
but, My schooling comes only if I don't.
Right. Well, maybe you'll almost do it as well. Here, Dick Cheney. I'm sorry, I misquoted him. He says he had other priorities. He didn't go. Let me see who's. I mean, there's so many of them here. It's just absolute. Jeb Bush was managed to avoid. Huh?
The only thing, the only names that come out right.
Yeah.
Are Republicans. What about the Democrats that have...
Well, when you go Al Gore served... I mean, the whole leadership of the Democratic Party are veterans. I mean, particularly in 2000, before. Tom DeLay, who is, you know, the leadership in the House, said he wanted to serve in Vietnam, but was able to since all the position had been taken by blacks and Hispanics. I mean, you gotta really love that. Newt Gingrich... a virtuoso in the art of hypocrisy, the former Speaker of the House, now claims the Vietnam War was a splendid idea, but at the time he opposed going himself. And it just goes on and on and on. Representative Dennis Hastert, he wasn't able to serve in the Army. He's the House Majority Leader because his knees weren't up to, although he did okay as a wrestler in college. Trent Lott. He didn't have to fight. I mean, you just go on. You know, Dan Quayle, the you know, the vice president. He was in the Indiana National Guard. I mean, you can just go through this. It's absolutely amazing. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Maybe you'll almost go to some more as well, like you know, the strong tradition in your family. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Long-time listener. Love your show. Keep
Thank
up the
you.
Good work. Point I want to make is that Bush had this wonderful tax break last year for people who made tons of money, but it didn't help you or I. Wouldn't it have been a smarter move to help the economy to offer some kind of an incentive to companies to keep their business in this country?
Well, there's a good idea. I mean, for sure. Yeah, you know, by the way, I thought, you know, people were really fooled about, you know, this tax cut. But somewhere or other, I can't find it in here, only 20% of the people say that that the tax cut affected them.
I mean, this made up maybe a dollar difference in my paycheck, you know, a week or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, so what, $50 a week didn't mean nothing, or a year didn't mean nothing to me. It seems like it would have been better for the economy to offer some sort of an incentive to companies to keep their business here in this country instead
sure.
of sending it to China or Mexico or wherever, you know.
Seems to make a lot of sense to me. I don't get it. I mean, these people running, well, I think that's why that Bush is now getting negative poll results for how he's handling the economy. I mean, you've got to really be a sap, a sucker, a rube, a mark to think that Bush is operating in anyone's interests other than the corporations. Why would they give him $130 million?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Appreciate it. Time for a few more calls before our interview, so stay with us if you're on the line. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, my name's Elliot.
Hi, Elliot.
Hi. I've been listening to your show for a little while now, not too long, but I just I have like a really good interest in politics and everything, and I just started. I got back into school. I'm doing political science and everything, and I agree with you. On a lot of things as far as, you know, Bush is concerned and, you know, like, I'm sorry, I'm nervous right now, sorry.
Well, never admit except under torture.
Yeah.
That's my first advice. Go ahead.
Okay, my dad didn't almost go. He actually did go to Vietnam, so, and he was there and, he got caught up in the draft and everything and, you know, I just,
Did you like that? I mean, I found that kind of odd. The guy was saying that my uncle almost went and somebody
yeah.
else in his family almost went.
Yeah, and, yeah, but, yeah, my dad went and, there's a lot of things that he really can't let go from that experience. And, he was there during the Tet Offensive and he was a medic. And, he's seen a lot of his friends die. And he's seen a lot of good men die.
Can you imagine even now when, we're starting to have this troop rotation, these men and women that have been in Iraq for a year and what they've seen and being at the scene of those bombings, of seeing their now 500 of their comrades.
The other day they hit the 500 mark.
Blown to bits. I mean, those images never leave you.
They never do. And my father, he afterwards, he worked in the VA hospitals for a little while, and for a long time, actually, until he got sick because of the Agent Orange. And I met a lot of veterans, a lot of these men, and I learned to gain a respect, a great respect for them, and to learn to, you know, appreciate, you know, the sacrifices they made. And it makes me even madder because they didn't get a lot out of it. You know,
no.
In my opinion, you know, because they went and they served, and yet the country's still in this kind of shape. You know, we still have to worry about our leaders taking too much from us and putting another generation through the exact same thing.
Well, yeah, and I wonder if people even remember Agent Orange. Agent Orange, in many ways, was this defoliant that they were trying to destroy, essentially, the environment of Vietnam so that they'd have better access to stopping the supply lines and all that, and to destroy the jungle. And little kids are still being born deformed in Vietnam from this, and and the government denies. The U.S. government denies that Agent Orange did anything to the people of Vietnam. It denies it did anything to American GIs, just like they're denying the Gulf War syndrome that affects, what's the figure, 25 or 35% of GIs that that served over there.
Yeah.
So these are just the, you know, when they do these tests or these polls or interviews with people, that the American military always ranks so high. And yet, you know, they're treated by these chicken hawks simply as cannon fodder.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous, and yet there are still so many people who support the government. And I think, I'm not sure on this, but I think I know one of the main things is because nowadays, especially my generation, because I'm 21, and, you know, the younger, you know, like the teenagers and everything, everybody is so into looks and material possessions, and it's like, as long as I got my cell phone, I got my car, you know, I got my, you know, I can go and party on the weekends, you know, it's like, okay, I don't care. As long as I have that, I'm fine. And it's like, it doesn't matter who's dying, it doesn't matter who's, you know, who doesn't have enough to eat, you know, as long as I have that, I'm fine. And then as soon as something happens to them, it's like, okay, now I want to stand up and say something. But it's like, come on, you know, people are so, I mean, you look around, everybody wants to wear the best clothes, everybody wants to drive the best car, and whoever has it is very arrogant. You turn on the TV, what do you see? You see stuff like, just reality shows with nothing but rich people. You hear about the paparazzi, you know, chasing around celebrities, and, you know, we're just like, we're worshiping these people, you know, and it's like, you know, everybody's forgetting about the man next to you, the people you work with, you know, everybody.
I'll tell you, for one thing, there are people of conscience among young people that are working for peace and social justice on one hand. On the other hand, it's kind of normal, particularly for young people, to be concerned with a lot of those aspects that you mentioned. I mean, it's a period when people are finally, you know, coming out from under their parents' control, where they're, you know, they're looking for life partners or for the night's partner. Also, I mean, that's not who we remember. We remember the young people in generations that stood up to power, that spoke for peace or social justice and altered the country. Hey, I got to go. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
And for being nervous, you did great. Thanks, thanks a lot. All right. Thanks for calling in for this segment. Stay tuned for the interviews. Talk next week.
They ripped up the X Games, the Gravity Games. They stole the show. And now, this Friday and Saturday, the superstars of freestyle are coming live. MMA Freestyle Motocross, presented by XM Satellite Radio. The best riders are back with a new bag of bigger tricks. You'll miss a power-packed field of 250cc motorcycles tearing through the air and hitting tricks so hard you won't believe it's real until you see it for yourself. Find out which one might bust out the backflip and more. And kid seats are still just $10. Excludes Gold Circle seats. Get your tickets now at Ticketmaster, the Palace of Auburn Hills box office, or charge it at 248-645-6666 or online at Ticketmaster.com or Palace. Smith.com. Tickets subject to convenience and handling charges. Adult seats $2 more than show. IFMA Freestyle Motocross. This Friday and Saturday. The Palace of Auburn Hills.
By crikey, we've been hunting down an unbeatable deal on Chevrolets, especially the ultimate utility vehicle, the Avalanche, and the unique Trailblazer.
Steve, better be careful. There are some man-eating dealers out there.
Terry's right. If I'm not careful, I could get bit right in my wallet by one of those snakes. That's why I'm going to Joe Pinion Chevrolet, the unbeatable dealer.
That's right. Joe Pinion Chevrolet is the unbeatable dealer, with 9 glorious acres of vehicles.
Plus, they'll beat any price, and get a load of this. They even have the hard to find 2003 Chevy Blazer. Plenty in stock and ready for immediate delivery.
Watch out, Steve! Other dealers only claim to give the best service, but at Joe Pinion Chevrolet, they stand by their word.
Here we are. Isn't it gorgeous? Joe Pinion Chevrolet in Southfield with Telegraph Beat 696, across from the Town 12 Mall.
Good job, Steve!
Check this out. Joe Pinion Chevrolet, the unbeatable dealer. 1-866-CHOW-1111. That's 866-CHOW-1111.
Chevrolet, an American revolution.
New capital gain rates mean dividends as well as gains on sales after May 5th, 2003 are taxed at 5 and 15%, down from 10 and 20% under prior tax law. Contact a tax professional for details.
And now, breaking news from Space Nightclub. 101 WRIF presents Saturday Night at Space. Doug Bodell's live in space for all the insanity. Get ready for Brutal Betty, the 300-pound, 60-year-old dominatrix.
Wait till I get my hands on you, you little punk. I'm gonna beat your ass.
Plus, you'll see the midgets on the Velcro wall, female impersonators, and Acrobasia, the world's greatest hand balancing act. Indoor fireworks, queen size beds, a snow machine, and topless male bartenders for the ladies. This and every Saturday, the Riff invites you to experience something outrageous.
What's the matter? Scared of an old lady?
Space Nightclub, 15 South Saginaw, downtown Pontiac. 21 and up only, doors at 9 p.m. Ladies in free before 11. For more info, click on spacepontiac.com. We're gonna blow your mind every Saturday night.
Punks.
Two new CDs are available now at DMRC stores.
Korn.
Korn's latest album titled Take a Look in the Mirror, featuring Right Now. The Offspring. The Offspring's new album, Splinter, featuring the single Hit That. Both CDs are in stores now on Sony Music Entertainment. Pick up the new Korn and Offspring releases at any of the following area stores.
Discs and Tapes Unlimited in Brighton.
Rockabilly's in Utica.
Switched On CDs in Novi.
Boogie Records in Toledo.
Rubber Soul in Ypsilanti.
The Rock Box in Southgate.
And Record Time in Ferndale and Roseville.
All stores are members of the Detroit Music Retailers Collective. Be independent. Shop independent. For more DMRC specials, check out Real Detroit Weekly.
Do you feel like half the man you used to be? Do you feel tired and irritable? Are you losing your sex drive? If so, you could have low testosterone.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. Testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now you can boost your testosterone naturally. Introducing Testostazine, the powerful new testosterone-boosting system I developed for men who are starting to feel their age. Testostazine supports your body's ability to produce testosterone the way you did when you were younger, so you can restore your energy, youthful sex drive, and staying power. Testosterone keeps a man energetic and sexually confident. You can feel that way no matter what your age. Testostazine can help.
Call now for your risk-free confidential trial of testosterone. Call 1-800-807-8108. 1-800-807-8108. Guaranteed to work for you or your money back. Call 1-800-807-8108. Results will vary.
Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby, on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. And we're going to talk about a subject that is roiling the nation. On one hand, I wonder why, but I guess That's not my end of things, to wonder why things are, but rather to talk about them and help all of us see a little more clearly. One person who helped with great clarity on the issue we're going to talk about is David Motes. And David Motes is the author of a book, Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage. And David Motes is the editorial director of the Rutland Herald, and that's in Rutland, Vermont. And the Rutland Herald was very instrumental in shaping the debate about gay marriage in Vermont. And in Rutland, Vermont, it's a pleasure to welcome David Motes to the Peter Werby Show. David, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we are all abuzz about gay marriage and the sanctity of marriages between a man and a woman or whatever, and civil unions and all of that. But frame for us, if you would, what your book tackles particularly, because this is a story, very dramatic, somewhat complicated, of the situation that occurred in Vermont.
Well, my book is largely focused on the struggle that occurred 4 years ago in Vermont, when the Vermont Supreme Court ruled that gay and lesbian couples had the right to marry under the Vermont Constitution. But it wasn't as simple as that. The court ruled that it would be up to the legislature either to grant gay marriage or what they called a parallel institution, which would provide the benefits and rights and responsibilities of marriage, which was called domestic partnership at the time, basically handed over the debate to the legislature. And during the course of the year 2000, the first 4 months, the legislature and the whole state were consumed by the fiercest political controversy I've ever experienced, at least since the days of the Vietnam War. It was that intense. And the result was that Vermont passed the civil union law, which allowed gays and lesbians to form civil unions, which were the equivalent of marriage. And that's what happened. The book tells that story. It also goes back as much as 30 years to sort of set it in the context of people's lives and the evolution of the gay rights movement.
I should mention as well, David Motes, that you won a Pulitzer Prize for your editorial coverage of this controversy in Vermont as well. Now, the legislature of Vermont decided that civil unions would be the way to go, and the bill was signed by one Governor Howard Dean. Am I correct?
That's right.
Is that going to come back to haunt him at all, do you think?
Well, at the time, he signed the bill, I wrote an editorial in which I said he pretty well signed away his any hope for running for president. Little did I know, I expected that that it would just cause him too much trouble in the more conservative parts of the country. But as he has run for president, he has tried to turn this to his advantage, and he has said, "Well, who else would have had the courage to sign this bill?" He thought it was the right thing to do, and despite public opposition, he signed it because he thought it was an important thing to do. And so I don't know how much it's going to help or how much it's going to hurt. At the outset, when no one knew who he was, he had significant support from gay and lesbian groups. Now all the Democratic candidates say they favor civil unions, if not gay marriage. And so he's right in the middle of the mainstream among Democrats on the issue.
Why wouldn't Howard Dean, the legislature, well, let's put it the other way, why didn't the Vermont legislature pass a gay marriage bill? Was that just seemed like that was just too far away from what our experience as our nation's laws?
Yeah, there was furious opposition, it would have been, at the very outset of the legislative session, House leadership concluded they just wouldn't be able to get the votes for a marriage bill, and with the court giving them the option, the civil unions was the path of least resistance, so that was even a difficult struggle. It only passed by a few votes on a very dramatic day, which is sort of the climax of my book, is when it finally did come to a vote, passed by a slim margin,
book is Civil War is a Battle for Gay Marriage. My guest is its author, David Motes. It's published by Harcourt. You're listening to The Peter Werbe Show. Did the vote to affirm Vermont civil unions, did it fall on liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican lines?
More Democrats than Republicans favored it. There was a minority of Republicans who came along. The Chief Justice who wrote the decision calling for gay marriage was a Republican, former Attorney General. The Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, who was the legislative leader most responsible for bringing it through, was a Republican. Not a majority of Republicans favored it. Although it broke down on party lines somewhat, but in the Vermont Senate it got even more partisan than in the House. Vermont has a tradition of liberal republicanism that still survives here. There's a list of liberal Republicans from years past: Robert Stafford, George Aiken, James Jeffords, who was a Republican until recently. So among some Republicans, they were willing to buck the party because they thought it was the right thing to do.
Well, did anyone pay a political penalty for this? In other words, subsequently in the elections that have occurred since, was anyone defeated that appeared on the basis of their vote to extend civil rights to other people?
Absolutely.
Really?
Some House members knew that they were basically signing away their political future by voting for it. And there was one state senator, a Democrat, who got up on the House. He was planning on voting against it. He was told by his fellow Democrats, "Hey, you can vote against this. We don't need your vote. Just to save your seat, you can vote against it if you want." But he was a high school teacher, and the night before the vote, someone called him. He was talking to a friend. He said, "What are you going to tell your high school kids, that you voted against it just to save your skin?" He got up on the Senate floor the next day and said, you know, he told that story. He said, "Yeah, I can't do that. I'm going to vote for it." He lost in the next election, and so the backlash took its toll. There were something like 16 House members who lost their seats, Republican and Democrat, and so happened that 2 years later, that particular senator, Mark McDonald, won his seat back. You know, the voters told him, "Well, we punished you, but we like you, so we're going to..."
Well, do you think these defeats were directly attributable to their votes for the gay civil union bill?
Huh? Yes. You know, some of these legislators talk about how friends of theirs, people who had supported them for many years, would no longer talk to them, you know, and they understood, you know, that was the reason.
And did the opponents of the people that took this forthright stand for extending civil rights to everyone in Vermont, did the opponents play upon this? They say, my opponent voted for the civil union bill, hence defeat him and elect me?
I would say probably so. The Republican strategy in the election that followed was to say that the legislature hadn't listened to the people. The presumption was that the people were against it, and the legislator had gone ahead and voted for it anyway. And so they didn't couch it in explicitly anti-gay language so much as they didn't listen, so we have to throw them out.
Gee, I wonder what they would have thought about civil rights legislation in the 1960s. I mean, you might still be able to put forth that argument as well. I mean, it's usually people that, through integrity and courage, are willing to take the steps necessary to make real the promise of democracy in this country. Well, Howard Dean, I have to say I can't remember all of Vermont history. He just did not run for governor again. Is that how he is ex-governor?
What happened was that this all happened in the year 2000, and in the election of 2000, he faced a tough re-election fight, the toughest he had faced. but he didn't run away from it. In fact, he met with groups of voters. He made a point of meeting with groups of voters who were unhappy with him about civil unions, and he'd hear them out, he'd listen to them, he'd explain his position. He did that. He had a number of events like that. And in fact, I heard an event on tape. He was surrounded by an angry crowd after a speech, and the radio captured this, and they were hammering at him, and he just stood there and took it and answered back, and one person said, Governor, are you bisexual? And he said, no. And so he took it, and he came away with, it was a three-way race, and he ended up with just over 50%. And so he survived that, and then that was his last election. He decided not to run for re-election in 2002.
Even the need to deny it, I always want to say I'm trisexual, particularly when I smoke marijuana and hugging a tree or something like that. David Motes, in your book, Civil Wars, you give voice to the people in the Vermont controversy over civil unions on both sides. What animated to such an extent the people that opposed civil rights being extended to their neighbors? Because obviously gay people are among us to the extent of 12 or 13%, maybe even a higher concentration. We know there's higher concentrations of gay people in, you know, some big cities, some states, and what have you. So they might be, you know, you might be saying spitting in the face of 15 to 20% of your neighbors. What was it, all religious?
A lot of it was religious. A lot of it is lack of familiarity, especially in a state like Vermont. You know, you go to the cities and the gay population is more evident and more out and everything. And we had, during the course of the legislative debate, there was a couple of public hearings where the legislature, the committees, opened up the state house and 1,500 people showed up, and 100 of them got to testify, and there were like gay people, all straight people, religious people, all kinds of people, and they all looked like just regular Vermonters with their, you know, their down jackets and their boots and their, and it was a revelation, I think, to a lot of people who were unaware of the reality that gay people live among them. That these regular-looking people have an interest in this, and so that sort of revelation occurred. It was a great education for the state of Vermont. That hearing, one reviewer said that the testimony in the hearing from gay people who were sort of like outing themselves for the first time was among the most dramatic material in the book. Religious qualms, lack of familiarity, a sense that marriage and the family is threatened, all that kind of motivates the opponents to this.
Gee. I mean, I always wonder about it. It threatens marriage. If you didn't have these strict all laws, in a sense, are artificial because they're created by human beings, that if you didn't have this, everybody would become gay. It's interesting that they have that perception of humanity. I live in the area in these two suburbs right outside of Detroit, Ferndale and Royal Oak, which are considered very gay-friendly areas. In fact, the councilman that won the most votes in Ferndale the last election was openly gay, so it's not startling to see manifestations of, well, you know, gay couples or gay life or big gay parades or what have you. It's just, you know, so you're right. A familiarity removes that fear and contempt and all these other kind of negative feelings that we have against our neighbors that have a sexuality different from what, you know, opponents think ones should have. But I mean, it seems like we've moved so far into the, you know, I mean, this seems, you know, the kids say it's so 20th century, you know, I mean,
right.
Well, it was on the cusp, but it was 2000. Does this all remain? Is it still an issue, and are people still worked up in Vermont?
No, the election that followed in 2000 was really the high water mark of the backlash, and what happened was the Republicans took control of the House after that, and they passed a bill that would have altered the civil union law, but the Senate didn't even look at it, and so the thing just died. The new governor, who was elected in 2002, is a Republican. He doesn't want to deal with it. In the campaign of 2002, no one talked about it. It settled in. A lot of people are proud of what Vermont did. Others are just happy to let it go and forget about it. I know justices of the peace who conduct civil union ceremonies, and they're happy and moved to do so. So it goes on, and other people who are unaware or unwilling to be concerned about it, the sky hasn't fallen. That's what a lot of people have said.
Well, I was going to ask, has marriage hasn't crumbled in Vermont?
No. Yeah. No, I mean, that's the odd thing about the arguments that were heard. A lot of people would say this threatens marriage, and then heterosexual married people would say, well, I don't know why it should threaten my marriage,
Has there been many Vermonters that have taken advantage of the civil union bill?
As of this summer, when I finished work on the book, there had been over 5,000 civil unions, and it was 800 and something of those were Vermont couples. The rest had come from all parts of the country, every state except Montana and North Dakota, even Michigan, and Canada, Vermont doesn't have that many people.
I was going to say, David Moats.
600,000, something like that.
David Moats is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. His book is called A Civil War is a Battle for Gay Marriage, about the story, the political struggle for civil unions in the state of Vermont a few years ago. And now this issue has kind of cropped up again. Let me see. You were saying about how many. Oh, yeah, about the people coming from outside. Is this symbolic? I know a couple that said, two gay women that say they're going to go to every state. They're going to get married or civil unionized everywhere they can. I don't know if that's like some sort of weird bigamy or what. I guess not. Not if you're dealing with the same person. But why are people coming to Vermont to have these civil unions? Does something accrue to them, or is it just symbolic?
If you're from out of state, it's mostly symbolic. Vermont's laws for Vermont couples, involving health care and probate and adoption and children and everything that would apply if you lived in Vermont. If you don't live in Vermont, it doesn't really have that much effect. So it's mainly symbolic. I know people who, they've been living together a number of years and they have a sense they've always had to live in the shadows and society doesn't really recognize their relationship. And now in Vermont, society does recognize So they want to make the trip, and they do. There was a story in the book. The very first day when civil unions were legal was July 1st, 2000, and the town clerk in Brattleboro, Vermont, decided to open her office at midnight and to carry out the first civil union ever because she had the request. And a couple of young women came and they had the first civil union, but there was another man who was 70 years old or something there, and he was there with his partner, and he reached across the counter and took her hand and said, you don't know how much this means to me. And they hugged and they cried, and it was a very moving kind of thing.
Well, I can imagine. I mean, what essentially the message is by denying the same rights to our fellow citizens is the same message that's always been when other members of our community have been. You're less than human. And, I mean, it's a terrible insult, and it's like so many things in this area. If you don't like it, don't do it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I feel safe in my marriage as well. But, the other idea was that that Vermont was going to be a magnet for gays, and suddenly the state was going to be inundated with gays. I mean, it sounds like they're worried about being inundated by anarchists the way the Miami,
right.
The way the Miami police were. I mean, I actually have a story after you answer, but David Moats, did many gays decide to settle? It would make sense in a state that says, hey, we recognize you as a human being, almost.
I don't think there's been a great influx of population or whatever. I think people recognize Vermont as a place of tolerance and so on, and a fairly liberal place, but there hasn't been a huge in-migration. But you make the point of how the mess message is that you're less than human, and the many of the legal arguments in the case before the Supreme Court drew parallels with the race and the cases in the past, which the laws in the past which barred interracial marriage, and these were cited in the Supreme Court arguments, and the racial parallel was very big in both helping people understand and also making the case in the court.
Well, the story I was going to tell you was that on my block, a house came up for sale, and somebody bought it, and my wife and I ran into this older woman in our neighborhood, and she said, a couple of men bought it. And I went, why is she whispering, you know?
Right.
And she said, they're gay. And I went, really? And I said, I hope she doesn't say anything bad, because I'm going to have to just, let her have it. And she said, that's really good. They really take care of their houses. So
right.
I'm thinking, the stereotype, and all stereotypes, they are what they are, but that actually, particularly gay men, do better by their neighborhoods and their communities and what have you. So you eventually have to retreat, I think, if you're anti-gay, into your own personal religious view of the world. And obviously, also near us, there's a gay church, so you can't even say all churches. But I don't think you have any right to make your individual beliefs determinative over someone else's life. I mean, that's really authoritarian.
Right.
Yeah. Just let me see if we have... maybe you can tell us this story about the national scold, Dr. Laura, and Governor Howard Dean.
After the Supreme Court decision came down in December 1999, Dr. Laura got on the radio and urged people to call Governor Dean to oppose gay marriage or civil union. And so his office was flooded with calls, but it wasn't just her. It was Christian radio all across the country was giving out phone numbers for senators and House members, and they were getting just tons of phone calls and hate mail and everything else during that time.
Well, it's good that the legislature and Governor Dean didn't let the squeaky wheels get the grease in this regard. We just have a minute or two left with you, David Motz, and we're heading into this election season. The Bush administration officials say they're planning an extensive election year initiative to promote marriage with $1.5 billion of our tax money. And also Massachusetts, they are at the point where remind us where Massachusetts is. I don't want to misstate it. Are gay marriages permissible now?
Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts ruled that gay marriage would be legal. They gave the Massachusetts legislature 180 days to act in response to their ruling. There's not much the legislature can do except lay out some procedures or whatever, because it's going to be legal. It would appear. I think some legislators are looking for wiggle room where they maybe can create civil unions instead. I think the constitutional amendment in Massachusetts is not going to go anywhere. So that's going to happen, I think, gay marriage in Massachusetts soon. The president's initiative about marriage, forgive me for being a little cynical, but $1.5 billion for marriage counseling or something like that, I would think that getting people jobs would do a lot better for people's marriages than something like that. So that was my response to that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. It's marriages very frequently falter because of economic situations. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy has said, in Civil Wars, David Motz tells an inspiring story of political courage that has the excitement of a thriller. The book is Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage. It's published by Harcourt. David Motz, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
You're logged on at WRIF.com. We'll get back to more Riff Raff in just a moment.
the Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine Online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like La Bisteca, located in Plymouth, proudly featuring certified Piedmontese beef. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine Online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Dr. Roach, put your best pace and body forward with help from Dr. Roach.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Now is the Riff's Rippin' Rock at 9 o'clock.
1 solid hour of your Riff rock and roll request.
All the excitement and fun you can bear.
With Meltdown, the big unit on the Riff.
Your opportunity to take control of the WRIF playlist
with the guy who lost control a long time ago.
Call in your Riff rock and roll requests to Meltdown at 313-298-WRIF or email them to meltdown@wrif.com.
The Rippin' Rock at 9 o'clock
with Meltdown.
He's in good trouble.
101.
W-R-I-F. We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment. This is 101 WRIF, broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. Thanks for listening.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine Online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like La Scala, located in the heart of Windsor's famous Little Italy district. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine Online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's 5 best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We got some great celebrity phone numbers. We had to try them. First, we called the 49ers' Terrell Owens, and then Brian Urlacher's girlfriend, Paris Hilton.
You have reached the Sprint voice mailbox of
81.
To leave a voice message, press 1.
Terrell, this is Jeff Garcia. I just want to say I'm not supposed to have a little cry with you the other day. It was around that scene. You cried, too, because I knew you cared. I love you. Bye, T.O. Giving him rides.
Hey, it's Paris. My screen is broken on my phone, so therefore I cannot read any of the numbers on it. So make sure to leave a number with a message, and I will get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, Paris. It's 54 here. Big Brian. Just thinking about putting it in your butt. Boom. Always say PH. How about a big 5-4? Up the old Yeah, I was thinking of running a post pattern right up the middle. When I see a hole, you know me, I gotta plug it up. Didn't mean to total a damn thing.
Good thing you love it.
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike. In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101 WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
Now and making sense of the words that are coming across it. We've been aware of some pretty awful circumstances involving human beings, some total disregard for human life, even in circumstances where the deaths wind up in the thousands, the tens of thousands. And if we go back to the 20th century, which wasn't too long ago, deaths often ranged in the millions in wars and in purposeful attempts to annihilate whole populations. It's a story that we're familiar with to varying degrees, often depends on our ethnicity, how closely we're aligned with the stories of what occurred. a tremendously interesting account of genocide is available from Princeton University in a volume called A Century of Genocide, Utopias of Race and Nation. And the author is Eric D. Weitz, and Eric D. Weitz is a professor of history at the University of Minnesota. He holds the Arsham and Charlotte Ohanessian Chair in the College of Liberal Arts. And Professor Weitz, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Not a very pleasant story of all the things that come to us in history. I mean, in many ways, history is a, sort of a history of a bloody sword to begin with. Genocide, though, the bloodiest of all swords. What directed you to this?
Right. Genocide is, as some people say, the crime of crimes. There are all sorts of human rights violations and atrocities, but genocide has to rank as the worst of them. And I came to this topic, much as you suggested in your opening remarks, that it is something that marks the 20th century. And as a historian, I felt compelled to try to understand it, to try to explain the phenomenon of deaths on such a massive and atrocious scale.
Now, as I noted, you're the chair of the Ohanessian chair in the College of Liberal Arts, and that's an Armenian name, and
yes,
they were victims, the Armenian people in Europe were victims of a genocide, yet it's not one of the genocides you cover. Were you directed to some extent to that because being in a chair named after an Armenian, and B, I guess, why not include that famous, well, I don't know how famous it is, that, but that genocide.
Well, it's becoming more and more well known. Unfortunately, there are many cases. There are more cases than I could deal with in one book. And I chose the cases, four of them that I deal with in detail, partly based on my expertise as a historian, the areas I know best, Germany and Russia and the Soviet Union. I know the histories of those places the best. And then I was also interested in exploring what influence those histories had on later cases. And those are the two other cases I deal with, Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge and the former Yugoslavia. There was also the case, for example, of the Herero in German Southwest Africa, present-day Namibia, between 1904 and 1908, where, by best estimates, about 60% of the Herero population was deliberately annihilated by the German military in the first few years of this century. So, unfortunately, there are many other cases that one could choose.
It's interesting you mentioned the Herero people. I just noted today that there was sort of a half-hearted apology by the German government to the Herero people. I don't know if you saw that.
Actually, I did not see it, but I will certainly look for it. This month is the centenary of the uprising of the Herero people against German colonial domination, which then triggered the deliberate war of annihilation carried out by the German military.
Most of us who live peaceful lives, and fortunately most of us in the United States have been able to do so, even with lives punctuated by, say, like the Vietnam War and the Second World War, where large numbers of Americans were involved in violence. Most of us live a pretty peaceful life. And so the question is always asked, how could these people do that to other people? But given the how frequently these occur, you could almost say quite easily. Would you say that's true?
Yes and no. There are so many cases that we know it's, in certain instances, difficult to guard against the outbreak of ethnic cleansing or genocide. But at the same time, not every people, not every country, not every place engages in such atrocious activities. In the book, I follow the United Nations definition, which was passed in 1948, the UN Convention on Genocide, on the Prevention of Genocide, in which the UN defined genocide as the intent, and the intent is very important here, to destroy, as the UN called it, an ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. And in the book, I try to provide an explanation for why the incidences of genocide increased in the 20th century and why they became so much more deadly. And there are quite a number of reasons, but I think one has to start from the fact that genocide is a deliberate political act. It's not a natural disaster. It's not something that just happens. It is the result of political decisions made by states or movements trying to become states at particular moments. And usually genocides happen in the context of war or tremendous internal social upheaval, or sometimes both at the same time. It's under the cover of war, when the normal rules of human interaction are abandoned, that particularly virulent regimes feel then they have the liberty to go out and annihilate entire populations. So we're not just talking about deaths that occur in military conflicts. We're not talking about deaths that occur from natural catastrophes. We're talking about politically inspired efforts to wipe out an entire population group.
I guess when I said earlier about it being seemingly easy, and in other words, you could have a political decision on the part of Hitler and the Nazi, or Stalin and the Communist Party, or Pol Pot, or Milosevic's people, but someone has to carry it out. Someone has to take all those people, at first, eyeball to eyeball, and like
right.
in Russia, these killing squads, and then herd them into concentration camps, gas them, see these piles of bodies that when we see these photographs, we're horrified. Well, somebody perpetrated that. Usually now we see them, they're 84 years old, but then they were 20, 21, 22-year-old Ukrainian or, whoever else that participated in this and saw this carnage, and so that there are shock troops willing to create these horrors.
Typically, we have multiple levels involved. And before the actual events of genocide themselves, there is a prehistory. And typically, that's a prehistory by which a certain group is dehumanized, categorized as the enemy. And the entire population is then subject to propaganda that this group, whether it's Jews in Europe, Muslims and Vietnamese in Cambodia, Chechens and Tatars in the Soviet Union in the 1930s and 1940s, whatever the group, typically it is subject to a dehumanizing process of propaganda, of political exclusion, and then in a situation of intense crisis it becomes easier for a regime to say that the way for our group to flourish is to annihilate this group that is the enemy. So we need a regime, a leadership, Slobodan Milosevic, Pol Pot, and the security troops that are under their direct command. But then typically what happens in the 20th century, and this is what makes genocide so deadly in the 20th century, that there is wide-scale popular mobilization, those kinds of individuals that you mentioned. Sometimes, young men, sometimes even boys, get organized into paramilitary groups. Or sometimes it can be the simple act of neighbors turning against neighbors. When, for example, Serbian paramilitaries moved into northern Bosnia into some of the villages. And they'd ask local Serbs, where are the Muslims? And local Serbs would point, down the road, that's where the Muslims live. Or when Jews or in Europe or Muslims in Bosnia were expelled, the local population comes and takes their apartments, takes their cattle, takes their belongings. Those are the ways in which populations become complicit in the act of genocide. Unfortunately, in the 20th century, genocides become social projects, started by states, involving security troops, but then also involving the mobilization of large segments of the population.
Eric Weitz is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. The book is A Century of Genocide, Utopias of Race and Nation. What does the subtitle refer to? Utopias of Race. I mean, this is a Germany without Jews, for instance?
Exactly. That the ideology that motivated the regimes that I discuss were ideologies of race and nation, even where we wouldn't expect that, as in the Soviet Union, which was a multinational, multi-ethnic empire, was not really a nation state. But in each of the cases with which I deal, the regimes target a specific specific ethnic or national group and then racializes them by saying that the nefarious characteristics, the negative characteristics of that group are carried in each and every single individual member of that group. So one of the things that regimes have to do is they have to categorize populations. I mean, cases of genocide, they have to categorize populations and they have to define who is a Jew, who's a Muslim. It's not always so obvious, but regimes go to great lengths, spend great amounts of energy trying to figure this out so they know exactly whom to target, whom they want to remove, and in the worst cases, annihilate.
Mm-hmm.
And then the promise is that for the dominant group, whether it's the Khmer, you know, Cambodians under the Khmer Rouge, or whether it's so-called Aryans, Germans, and Nazi Germany, the promise is that the dominant race or the dominant nation will flourish once the dangerous groups are removed.
Well, I was going to say, the dominant group always avers that it is the victims of the group that's being exterminated.
Yeah, that's a very important point. There's this incredible language of self-pity that one finds in all of these cases. I mean, in 1941, 42, when German armies are astride the entire continent of Europe, there is this self-pitying rhetoric of the dangers that Jews pose to Aryan Germany, or again, the Cambodian example, the dangers that the Muslim minority or the Vietnamese minority pose to Khmers in the former Yugoslavia and Bosnia, in Serbia and Bosnia, the same kind of self-pitying rhetoric from Serbian leaders like Milosevic, who postulate again that if you get rid of the threatening group, then finally Serbs will flourish as they have never flourished before.
Now this is interesting you mentioned about Pol Pot, because I was going to ask who was their genocide aimed at, because we, most of us know how murderous the Pol Pot regime was, but it's usually portrayed on a basis of this extreme ideology and almost this insanity of this murderous insanity. But this was a genocide aimed at specific groups within Cambodia?
In each of the cases I discussed, you have all sorts of killings that occur in association with the specifically genocidal killings. In no case that I know of are the only people killed those who are of the subordinate ethnic, national, or racial group. For example, Serbs in Bosnia who tried to protect their Muslim neighbors were killed by Serb paramilitaries. They obviously were not killed for their ethnicity or nationality, but for their humanitarian stance, their political stance in defense of their Muslim neighbors. The same thing happened in Rwanda when moderate Tutus tried to protect Tutsis or families of mixed background. They, too, were killed because of their moderate political beliefs. Now, in the specific case of Cambodia, what you have are an almost unfathomable number of killings. Probably 30% of the Cambodian population died in the 4 years of Khmer Rouge rule. Now, some of them died from the effects of malnutrition and disease because of idiotic economic development policies. Some were the victims of political killings because they opposed the Khmer Rouge, or the Khmer Rouge feared that these people were potential political opponents. And in addition, the specifically genocidal component of those 4 years was that the regime targeted specific minority groups, including, as I've mentioned, Muslims and Vietnamese. In all of these instances, the regimes have this vision of a homogeneous society, and that's what I think is really dangerous, and those are what are the danger signals for all of us. Looking around in other cases, other places around the world.
Well, it gives utopia a bad name.
It does indeed, and I think unfortunately, not all utopias are are good ones.
Yeah. Now, this was what I knew the least about, the Pol Pot experience. To some extent, Stalin's genocide in the Soviet Union, which I'd like to get to in a minute, because of the recent history in the former Yugoslavia, I think a lot of people probably know the Serb activities in Bosnia. Now, on the other hand, probably the best-known genocide, perhaps in history, maybe, I don't know if it deserves to be absolute number one or whether there should even be a derby, but is Nazi Germany,
yeah.
And that's certainly ground that is well-trod.
Yeah.
What do we find new in your book, Century of Genocide, that we wouldn't say, oh, yeah, I know all about that. They killed 6 million Jews, and some people know they killed a few million other people as well.
I think what's really new in the book is the comparison, is situating Nazi Germany and the Holocaust in a comparative framework. And I am a historian of Germany by training. You know, that's what I know best. That's my background, intellectually, academically. But I think the singular focus on the Holocaust and the claim that some people make that the Holocaust was a unique event, that, I think, is very misplaced. So someone who is, you know, very, very, very well acquainted with the historical literature on the Holocaust might not find any new facts as such in my chapter. But what that person hopefully will see, may or may not agree with me, but hopefully will see, is that there are other instances of similar atrocities that have occurred in the 20th century. And similar does not mean that they were exactly the same, but it means that we can look at them together and think about similarities and differences.
Now, there is, I mean, I don't, and the last thing in the world I want to be is offensive to anyone, is there's almost gets to be a sense of ownership. And you kind of hit upon that. Some people say that the Holocaust that the Jewish population of Europe faced was unique. There's a big debate as to whether there actually was a genocide of the Armenians. And here we are in the case of, I'm not doing my math real well, probably at least 70 or 80 years for Armenia, now 60 years or more for the Jewish genocide, and yet there's still such passion there. Maybe you could speak to that. What are the emotions that seem to still roil people, particularly those of that ethnic group? I don't know that it's of such importance to the population at large.
Well, let me start with the Armenian case, because by and large, historians who look at that history understand without question that there was a genocide, that there was a deliberate attempt to wipe out the Armenian population of what was then the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Ottoman Empire. In the Armenian case, it took many generations, two and a half generations, before there was a renewed public discussion about those events. And in the Armenian case, we have the really difficult situation that the Turkish state refuses, contemporary Turkey, present-day Turkey, refuses to admit that there was a genocide. And more than that, conducts a deliberate campaign to obscure the history. So the fact that there is a deliberate campaign of denial by the Turkish state in many ways keeps this issue very much alive, very raw. That's one factor. I mean, the other factor is that indeed these populations suffer tremendously. Now, we're now far enough along from the Armenian events that there are very, very few survivors. But it is indeed important to keep the memory alive of the Armenian genocide as well as the other cases, so that hopefully, people will learn from those events and think about ways to prevent similar tragedies from occurring in different places and different times.
Well, I mean, we have the slogan, and although I think the surviving Jews meant that would never happen again to Jews, but they say never again, yet it has happened again. And I was thinking, you know, through the course of our conversation about you have to have first a despised and identified sector of the population, and I could imagine one, who now is undergoing great suspicion in the United States. And if we felt fearful that these people were at the root of future terrorist acts, that we, our communities were in danger because of them, I mean, given what we've seen in the past, to say it can't happen here probably isn't true.
Well, one would hope that American democratic traditions are strong enough to ensure that that would not happen here, but one can never, one can't predict the future, one can't be absolutely certain. There are instances in American history of genocidal events against particular Indian populations, in California, in Massachusetts, there are others, so our own history is not completely free of these kinds of gross violations of human rights. In the 90s saw two terrible cases, former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, mm-hmm. but out of those cases, out of those tragedies, there are also some hopeful signs. The UN Convention on Genocide lay unused for 50 years. Now we have two tribunals convened by the Security Council, and they are making enormous advances in human rights enforcement. So those are hopeful signs for the future.
Well, this, and I know you know, this is an extraordinarily large subject and subject to debate, but how do we ensure, on one hand, that these memories don't die at the other, on the other hand, and I think you know where I'm going with this, but don't have the time to really go too far, that it doesn't become an industry? I mean, let me just leave the question at that. How do we keep these memories here without it, things that happened? And how long do we have to hold them as public and social memory?
I think we hold them forever.
Okay.
Yeah, I just like we hold important democratic advances like the American Bill of Rights, like the Declaration of Independence, just as we hold those in memory forever, because they are important touchstones of democratic practices, of what we today call human rights, and we don't want to forget those. I think we also keep in memory the violations of human rights. So we broaden our perspectives and think about other peoples around the world who may have been victims of such atrocious campaigns by state. So I don't think there's ever an end point of memory. But in response to the other part of your question, I think the study of history also should tell us that we don't need to be imprisoned by the past, and we don't use the past simply to wallow in a sense of victimhood. We use the past to learn about how we can at least potentially live together. And in that way, guard against making this an industry by not constantly repeating the lament of victimhood, but going beyond. If one is a member of one of those groups that was so victimized in the past, trying to go beyond the identification solely with one's own group and think about how other people live in this world and how other people struggle to find a life of decency and respect, and how sometimes they have to struggle very hard against marauding armies and states.
The book is A Century of Genocide, Utopias of Race and Nation. The author is Eric D. Weitz. And David Chandler, author of Brother Number One, A Political Biography of Pol Pot, says about it, "This is a passionate, persuasive, and elegantly argued study of the genocidal policies and behavior of four 20th century regimes that are rarely systematically compared." It is published by Princeton University Press. Professor Weitz, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby and produced by OD. Stay tuned for more Riff Rock coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
King Henry, why are you looking so sad?
My fourth wife is making my life miserable. I was thinking of having her beheaded like I did the others, but these new women's rights groups are giving me a very hard time.
Today, there's a better way to end your marriage. Simply call Adam. Adam is the American Divorce Association for Men. Let Adam take the misery out of your divorce while they protect the rights of men.
Your Highness, the Queen requests an audience with you.
Okay, show her in.
Hello, Henry, my dear. I understand you've hired Adam to handle your divorce.
That's right.
Well, why don't you come up to my chamber tonight and perhaps we could bury the hatchet,
You don't have to lose your home, your children, or your money in a divorce. Call Adam, the American Divorce Association for Men. They answer your questions about divorce at no charge. Call 248-356-ADAM.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Good morning. This is Ray Vinson of American Equity Mortgage. If you're hearing our message at this time, it's probably because you're at work, driving around, or can't sleep. If you can't sleep, I hope it's not because of money problems, but if it is a money problem, American Equity Mortgage can help. You're not alone. The average household has a credit card debt of $6,000 or more and paying a fortune in interest. You see, if you're a homeowner, you can use the equity in your home to consolidate all your bills and have only one payment. Think about that, just one new low monthly payment. Your equity can be used to pay off your auto loans, credit cards, and get a new low fixed rate on your mortgage. You will be saving hundreds of dollars each month. American Equity Mortgage specializes in homeowners with less than perfect credit. We have helped thousands of people just like you get back on track. You can call our office right now, and a loan specialist will call you first thing in the morning. That's American Equity Mortgage. Call toll-free 888-71-LOAN-1, 888-71-L-O-A-N, then the number 1.
This is another Riff Rock concert.
Calling all Hellraisers. The American Badass brings it to Detroit. Are you ready?
Some techno will rock this place.
Live. In rock.
Drop the boogie.
He's Whiskey Ben. And he's hellbound.
Cowboy Badass and Black singing.
He will blow your mind.
I feel like making.
March 25th at the Palace.
I feel like making love.
Tickets are on sale now. Available at the Palace Box Office and all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge 248-645-6666. Online at cc.com or palacenet.com. Be sure and pick up Kid Rock's new self-titled CD.
I feel like making
it. It's gonna be big.
Now.
And it's gonna be bad. Then it's got to be Kid Rock with special guest Puddle of Mud.
The Riff Rocks with Rick Fox. We've got more non-stop rock. On the Riff.
Okay, so I decide I want something big and manly rumbling between my legs. And all my friends say, we know this doctor in Canada. I can hook you up lots of little blue pills, eh? And I say, no! I want to buy a bike! I want to buy a Harley-Davidson motorcycle! So all my friends say, buy a bike in Motown! So me, being so dumb, decided to shove the competition. The other dealers all scream in my face, MSRP! MSRP! And I think, WTF. Then they tell me I have to order it and wait like 5,000 years to get my bike and wait and wait and wait. And then my head explodes. Then I take my friend's advice and I go to Motown, Harley Davidson, and Taylor. They take me right to my bike and tell me I can ride it away today. And I say, no way. Then they say, today. And I say, no way. Then they say, today. And I say, okay. And now I am riding my Harley and I can buy all that other stuff I wanted because I got a great deal at Motown. And now I may even go to Canada to buy those little blue pills in bulk. for this weekend. The end.
For sales, specials, events, or just to look at cool pictures, log on to MotownHarley.com. Motown Harley Davidson in Taylor on Telegraph, just north of Eureka.
Remember, guys, chick stick a guy on the Rio motorcycle. Buy a bike at Motown! Okay.
Time to call on the pro.
Number one in the morning. Number one for rock.
Claire Lane, you've let yourself become drunk with power.
WRI.